Welcome to the Bull Simons Op Center Podcast, where warriors share their stories about key events in military history. Arthur D. Bull Simons was a legendary Special Forces soldier who is famous for leading the Son Tay raid into North Vietnam in November 1970 to rescue American POWs. The Bull Simons Op Center is a program of the nonprofit Simons Center for Ethical Leadership and Interagency Cooperation on Fort Leavenworth, Kansas.
Terry Buckler was the youngest member of a joint group of volunteers from the Army Green Berets and Air Force Special Operations. The 56th Green Beret raid on the Son Tay prison camp in North Vietnam ranks as one of the riskiest missions in Special Ops history. Terry grew up on a farm in Clark, Missouri. On March 18, 1969, he was drafted into the U.S. Army. 3 days later, he extended his service to be a member of the U.S. Army Green Berets. Terry is president of the Kansas City Special Forces chapter of the Green Berets and a member of the Son Tay Raiders Association. His awards include the military's third highest decoration, the Silver Star, awarded for gallantry in action, the Combat Infantry Badge, Vietnam Service Medal, Parachute Badge, and Good Conduct Medal. In 2019, Terry received the Philip Pistilli Silver Veterans Medal from the Harry S. Truman Foundation. Terry Buckler, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today. We look forward to hearing your phenomenal story. Please take us back.
It's an honor to be here today, and I appreciate the opportunity. Bull Simons was a great leader.
Awesome. Yeah, glad to be able to contribute to his legacy and certainly hear your stories and among many others that we have planned coming up here in the near future. So, Terry, obviously we're going to talk about the Son Tay raid. Can you take us back and tell us what you had been doing in the Army up until the Son Tay raid?
Certainly. Well, I was drafted in the military at the age of 18. I did my basic training at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, and also did my AIT training there for 12 Bravo, combat engineer. After the I did my basic in AIT, I got on a plane, flew to Fort Benning, Georgia, first time I'd ever flown. And landed at Fort Benning, went to jump school, made my required jumps, went from there into Fort Bragg, where I started my training for Special Forces. I went out to Camp McCall, did the 8 weeks of hell out there, and passed through that course, and was then assigned to 7th Group. Yeah, well, did my advanced training in Special Forces for demolitions and engineering, and finished that course and was assigned to 7th Group. I was teaching mountain climbing and rope tying up at Nantahala National Forest at the time that Bull Simons came on the base and was looking for volunteers for a moderately hazardous mission.
So, is that how you put it?
That's how he described it. Said we'd be back by Christmas, and he was looking for volunteers.
Yeah, so you volunteered for that mission not really knowing what you were getting into?
Correct. The call went out on Smoke Bomb Hill, which is the home of the Special Forces there at Fort Bragg, and he said Bull Simons was going to be down at what we referred to as a little White House. So myself and a few of my buddies went down just to see what was going on. There was about 500 of us there, and most of them were all well-seasoned troops. And he came on stage, said he was looking for volunteers for, like I say, a moderately hazardous mission, and no TDY would be provided. So that eliminated a few of the people. And he said, if you're interested, come back here 1300 hours and we'll start an interview process. There was two sergeant majors did the interviewing, and everybody was interviewed that wanted to volunteer for the mission. So I did my interview, and at that point I kind of thought, well, they listened to me anyway, they give me the opportunity. I loaded back up on a deuce and a half and went back up to Nantahala Forest, where we were training up in the mountains of North Carolina. And about a week later, my CEO called me in, said, pack your bag, you're going back to Fort Bragg, and you've been selected on the for this mission. And that's kind of where it all started then.
Wow. Did you really know much about Bull Simons at that point when you were in the room and he was asking for volunteers?
Bull Simons was the John Wayne of the Green Berets. And everybody knew Bull Simons and knew that he was a no-nonsense man and had quite a history, not only in special forces, but in the military as well. He was a member back in World War II. Bull Simons was the actual oldest man on the mission. He was 52 years old when he went on. It's not very often you see a full-blown colonel on the ground in a mission where we were initially told after we knew where we were going, we had a 50-50 chance of not making it back. And he said, anybody wanted to back out, now's the time to do it. No one did, though. So,
yeah,
of the 56 of us.
And I find it interesting, prior combat experience, prior experience in Vietnam was not a requirement.
None. My only combat experience was fighting my brothers.
And you were really fresh out of all this. You're all your schools complete, but you really hadn't even made it into a regular unit yet.
Maybe 6 months at the most at that time. Okay. And had volunteered for Vietnam a couple of times, but never got selected to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I went down in as the advance party. And there was 109 of us selected out of all those that interviewed. And then the actual number on the mission was 56 mm-hmm. on the ground. But so I went down in the advance party. I was a buck sergeant, you know, E5. And in the special forces, that's about like being a private because that's the lowest rank in SF. Mm-hmm. E5 buck sergeant. So my first duties when we got down there was we put the mock up. We didn't know what it was at the time. It looked like two befores with toilet paper wrapped around them from a distance. Mm-hmm. And our job was to put up the compound, the mock of the compound. And then also the TOC building was that we had. The Air Force came in and swept it for listening devices and everything like that. Once that was verified that it was a clean building, we put a concertina fence up around it, put a field phone into the building, and it was guarded 24/7. And that was one of my jobs when I wasn't working or sleeping or training. I was playing guard duty, and that went on for about the first month of my time at Eglin Air Force Base, where we were doing our training, auxiliary field number 3.
Mm-hmm. And the mock-up was built at Eglin?
Yes.
The auxiliary?
It was what they had done. There was a lot of questions about it in the book we talk about. We clarified some point. Everybody thought we used to take it down every night. Well, it took us about a week to put it up. And we didn't know what we were doing at the time because we were just going by what they told us. They wanted the post stuck in the ground, and they used target cloth around it to make the doors and the windows and everything to represent what we later found out was the compound itself. So, but at the time, we were wrapping two befores with target cloth, and they did some SR-71 pictures of it to see if it would be detected, and it wasn't. So it was not taken down daily. It was left up. Actually, it was left up a week or two after we left Eglin to go to Tak Lee Air Force Base in Thailand. So, but it was kind of recorded that it was taken down, but it really wasn't.
And how long were you training over and over and over down there at Eglin with the mock-up?
We did a little over 170 rehearsals, and we went down there in September, And October or November the 20th, we went in 2021, we went into Sante. So we trained up till a few days before we left Eglin Air Force Base. And we started out, we would do a walkthrough. And then after we got proficient in the walkthrough, we'd do a run through. And then after we got proficient at that, we did a run through with live ammo. Mm-hmm. So we were getting the experience of understanding, feeling what we were doing, knowing what each man's responsibility. There were three different elements, red line, which I was a part of, green leaf, which was the assault chopper, and blue boy. And blue boy was the chopper that we forced to crash into the compound itself. And so, and within each element, we had different groups. You had designated a job role when they hit the ground. And then we had also, not only did we have it with all three choppers, then we went into situations where maybe one chopper went down. So we had to, if green leaf went down, we had to go to plan green. If red wine went down, we'd go to plan red wine. And on same for Blue Boy. So, and everybody knew we had trained. I tell people in the military, you know, training saved our tails, I think, because when we did go to an alternate plan, everybody knew exactly what they were supposed to do. No questions asked. Just, you know, it was just like we were training back at Eglin Air Force Base.
Wow.
And training, we started in the daytime. And then we added the choppers when we started doing nighttime training. And most of our training after about the first, probably 2 weeks, 3 weeks, was done at night. And we'd do three runs every night. And you know, we kind of slept in the daytime unless you were pulling guard duty like I was doing. But it was part of the process. When we first got down there to Eglin, we started the PT, making sure everybody was kind of in good shape. We did some did some of our MOSs. We went back and through just as a kind of a briefing, you know, a quick overview of what we did. You know, we did, I was a demolition, so we were doing some things with C4 and deck cord and things like that. The weapons guys were doing theirs, the combo guys. So everybody was kind of getting a refresh of their MOS.
Yeah.
And that was about a week or two of doing that type of stuff. And Dick Meadows, who is another icon in the Special Forces world, we used to do the Meadows Mile, which was about a 2 mile run every morning. And that was just to make sure we were in shape and ready to do whatever needed to be done. And, you know, I was 20 years old at the time, so I was in pretty good shape to start with.
Right.
Pappy Kittleson was the oldest non-com, and Pappy was 46. And he was on the – a lot of history was made the night of the raid. For instance, Pappy Kittleson was the only American to be on four POW raids. He was the youngest on Cabanatuan in the Philippines when we rescued, or they rescued 513 POWs. And he was the oldest non-com on Sante. So great man, wonderful, wonderful individual.
Wow, incredible. Well, hey, Terry, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Okay.
The U.S. Army Commander General Staff College on Fort Leavenworth celebrates its 140th anniversary in 2021. It was founded by General William Tecumseh Sherman in 1881 as the School for the Application of Cavalry and Infantry. The CGSC Foundation supports the development of leaders of character and competence at the college for ethical service to the nation in three general areas: scholarship, outreach, and soldiers and family support. You can contribute to the Margin of Excellence by making a tax-exempt contribution through our website at cgscf.org/donate. That's cgscf.org/donate. All right, we're back talking with Terry Buckler, who was the youngest member of the Special Operations Force that went into Sante POW prison camp in North Vietnam. So, Terry, you've given us everything leading up to all the training down in Eglin and the mock-up of the POW camp in North Vietnam at Son Tay. When did you guys finally leave the U.S., and what was your trip over to Vietnam, and how long were you guys in country before the raid took place?
They came in one day while we were at Eglin and told us to pack a bag. We were leaving tomorrow. So we packed our duffel bags, and they took us to C-140 was setting in at Eglin, and they took us there and deuce and a half with the curtains all pulled, put us in the hangar, loaded us on a C-141, and we flew to not knowing where we were going. We just knew we were going somewhere in a C-141. 28 hours later, we landed in Thak Le Air Force Base in Thailand, and we went to a CIA camp there. That was where we spent the next few days waiting for the word. This was the first time a mission had been in direct control of Joint Chiefs of Staff. And so they were trying to decide if it was a go or no go. President Nixon finally gave the word to go. And we were told to be in through the auditorium. We had a little auditorium over there at 1800 hours. And I was on the 20th of November. We went into the building, and Bull Simons and Colonel Sidner came on stage. They had a big map, pulled out a big map of North Vietnam, had a big circle around Hanoi, and then another circle around Son Tay. Bull Simons told us, gentlemen, we're headed there tonight. We're going to rescue 60 to 70 POWs. And it was like, that you could have heard a pin drop. It was just dead silence. And then all of a sudden it was like...
How far is Son Tay from Saigon?
From Saigon? Oh, golly. Well, it's 23 miles northwest of Hanoi.
Okay.
So we were way up north.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, wow. We were closer to China than we were anyplace else.
Okay.
And about 100 miles outside of Laos as well, or to the Laos border.
Wow. This on the day you landed was the day you got the brief saying we're going tonight?
No, we were at Thak Le for about 2 or 3 days,
just okay,
waiting for the word.
Uh-huh.
And
but not long, yeah.
You know, we knew we were on some type of rescue, but we didn't know where or when, mm-hmm, and or who. And then when Bull Simons told us where we were going and what we were going to do, it's like a cannon went off. I mean, everybody jumped up, hollering and whistling, and said, let's go get them. And Colonel Sidner said, well, gentlemen, we have a 50-50 chance of not making it back. And if anybody wants to back out, now's the time to do it. But nobody did. He said, go get your gear and meet. We had a hangar where we had all of our equipment stored in, weapons, radios, and stuff like that. So we went and got all that. Boarded a 130 that flew us from Thak Le to Udorn in Thailand. And we got when we got to Udorn, our choppers were on the runway. There was no lights on the runway. There was no communications going on between the choppers or between the chopper pilots and the conning tower. We knew which chopper was in line for us. We got on our chopper, and we took off for a 3.5-hour flight.
What kind of helicopters were you using?
Say again?
What kind of helicopters were you guys in?
There were 5 H-53s, HH-53s. Uh-huh. 2 were spares in case there were more POWs than we expected. And there was Red Line, Greenleaf, and Blue Boy. Now, Blue Boy was in an HH-3 because a Huey was too small. Mm-hmm. But that's the interesting part about that. And we flew like a flock of geese from the ground. It looked like geese flying in a V, but the HH-3 was flying in the draft of the C-130. Now, the C-130 was flying at 5 knots above stall speed. They were flying 105 to 104 knots, and the HH-3 was keeping up with it. I might add, too, that we refueled in air and with no lights and no communications between the pilots of the tankers, the Line 1 and Line 2, and we flew without any other than navigation all the way into Sante. As we were arriving at Sante, so it was about a 3.5 hour flight, so we had plenty of time to think about, you know, being 20 years old, my best friend was getting married at that time, and I'm halfway around the world. I said I'd never forget his wedding date, but it was an interesting time. Had a lot of time to think about it, a lot of time to talk to the man above. So this was my first time in combat, and so it was a very interesting ride in, a long ride, I might add.
Yeah. But, and you mentioned earlier that part of the plan was one of the helicopters was either, you know, crash landing or force landing into the middle of the prison camp.
Correct. Blue Boy's mission was to crash inside the compound. The idea there was the planners felt like they had a minute to be for the raiders to take control of the guards, because they didn't know whether the guards were given the orders to shoot POWs if there was a rescue attempt. So the idea was to get in the compound as fast as we could, and the best way to do is to crash inside, but to control the crash, but it's still a crash, mm-hmm. and to get down quick. They took out one of the HH-3 on its path over the compound, took out one of the towers. There were three towers on the guard towers on the compound, and Blue Boy took out one on the way in, and then when they crashed, they ran to that one, took out the third tower, as well as control the guards.
And when you say take out the tower, I mean the helicopters ran it over, or the door gunners were lighted
They had door gunners. Uh-huh. They opened up their door gunners on it, and you know, they were all carrying miniguns mm-hmm. on them. So they were taking them out, but they had to make sure they didn't hit any of our POWs in the rooms that they were being held captive in. Mm-hmm. So that was all done in the rehearsal process as well, of knowing where they could shoot and where they couldn't shoot, and making sure they didn't injure any or kill any of our POWs. So once we flew in, and just before we got into Sante, the C-130 that was our mothership, she raised up and dropped the flares over the compound as we were landing. Mm-hmm. And I was an RTO for our element and radio operator. And just as we were landing, I heard on my radio, it came on Plan Green. And I said, this can't be. So I radioed back to say again. And Sergeant Howe said, we're going to Plan Green. Well, Plan Green to us meant that Greenleaf had been shot down or had engine trouble and was out of the, not going to be available mm-hmm. to help us. And so I turned to Dan Turner, who was my captain, and I told him, Dan, Captain, we're going to Plan Green. He got that old shit look on his face and said, well, pass it on. So we passed it down the line to the rest of the guys on our ship. And when we hit the ground, we knew exactly what we were to do, because we had rehearsed it so many times, both with all three choppers and then without a Plan Green meant Greenleaf wasn't with us. But Greenleaf had 22 guys on it. So we went from 56 guys minus 22, mm-hmm. So which was pretty good cut. We had thought they'd probably been shot down or something, uh-huh. but no way of knowing that at the time. So we went into our alternate plan, and what happened, Greenleaf's pilot had drifted off, and there was a compound south of us that had a good resemblance to the Sante, but we later discovered that was probably Chinese officers training the NVA on how to use SAM missiles and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it was, I think it was a blessing that this happened, because they estimated a little over 100 guys there. And they did a pretty good job of ruining their graduating class that night. And what happened, the pilot realized what he had done. So he just circled back around, dropped back down and picked up Greenleaf. And then by this time, we had already dismounted and Blue Boy was inside the compound. And we were all doing our job. And then Greenleaf came back and landed where they should have in the first place. And then they caught up with our guys, the red wine guys that were taking out the building where the guards were. So Dan and I, our job was to get to the communication building as quickly as we could and eliminate any thought. Our Bull Simons had told us we are not to take any enemies. Rescue, we don't want anyone. Everyone's to be neutralized on the way through, because we were going to come right back through that same area to get on our choppers. That's where the LZ would be back there for exiting the compound. So we had to neutralize everybody on the way through, and that was what our job, and get to the communication building as quickly, because we were 23 miles from Hanoi. They estimated 20 to 200,000 troops in the area. And Bull Simons, our E&E plan, Bull Simons is pretty creative. Our E&E plan, the Sante was in a bend of the Sauk River, and we were going to back up to the Sauk River and make them pay for every inch of that land coming across. He wanted to keep us together. There was no way they'd get a rescue in for us. So if there was he said we would know if there was a security breach by the time the second chopper hit. So if there was a security breach, we were going to back up to the river and make them pay for it. But fortunately, we didn't have to do that. We got in. They estimated we could be on the ground no longer than 30 minutes before reinforcement would be coming in. Now, what took place that night is the largest aircraft assault of the Vietnam War was done. There was 116 planes flew in over Hanoi dropping flares. So they were a decoy from us coming out on the other side. So we were basically being protected by the Navy from just dropping flares on it. And the NVA didn't know which way to turn. So, but we got in, and just as we were getting to the commo shed, I heard my second bad news that night was no items. I had a headset on so I could hear with one ear and what was going on the radio, and the other one was off so I could hear Captain Turner talking to us. And when we heard that there was no items was code word for POWs. And it was just kind of like, oh, this can't be. You know, we trained for everything, but we did not train for no POWs. So they went back through all of the buildings, making sure that there wasn't somebody hiding or there was no man going to be left behind. And so after they did that, they started bringing back the choppers. The choppers let us off, and then they took off and landed in another location about a half a mile from us and waited for us to call them back in. And so we were on the ground, and we were coming back. And we had taken a chainsaw in to cut down the light poles where we were going to set up our LZ. Unfortunately, the light poles were made of concrete. So chainsaws just don't cut concrete too well. So we had to move our LZ further out. And the guys that were setting up the LZ did a great job at getting that done. And so we were getting back on the bird, and we're doing head count. Make sure all the bodies that went in were coming back with us too, and we were one man short. So we did another head count, and we were still one man short. So we did a third head count, and this time Dan Turner counted himself. So we were good to go, and we started out, and Captain Turner and I were sitting on the tailgate with a PJ between us, and when the chopper lifted and looked turn to go south, where you could look over Hanoi. It was like looking out over Los Angeles. I couldn't believe how bright it was. And we hadn't been in the air hardly any time, and about that time our chopper took a dive. We thought we were crashing, and just as we were doing that, a big SAM missile flew up our tail. And that's the first time I'd ever seen a SAM missile, and the last time. But it was got kind of exciting right there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, on the ground, we can run and hide, but when you're up there in the air, them flyboys, there's no place to go. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, we had great pilots, and they were dodging them and flying them, and we made it back in good shape. So
well, that's incredible, and brought everybody back also.
I'm sorry?
And everybody got back.
Yes.
All members of the mission.
We had two injured, one in the Air Force. When they crashed inside the compound, mm-hmm. the fire extinguisher fell off. And the Air Force engineer broke his ankle. Mm-hmm. And then Joe Murray, Sergeant Murray, got shot in the back of the leg. And that was the only injuries we had, so on our end. And mm-hmm. We neutralized everyone in the camp and came back through that same area we walked through or ran through. And made it back in good shape. We had one F-104 went down. I got hit by a SAM, and Tom Lowry was on that bird, and they rescued him the next morning. They saw where they landed mm-hmm. when they parachuted out, and him and the pilot. And the next morning, they got him in, got him out in good shape. So no loss. That was the only plane that we lost that night.
Yeah.
And everything else went as planned, except for no POWs.
You ever know for sure why the POWs had moved the night before? Or they only moved a couple of days before, right? The POWs?
The next day... a couple of days later, the POWs, at that time, there was 12 camps scattered throughout North Vietnam. And I think there was about 500 POWs at that time. And what they did, they brought all these POWs into Hanoi. And a lot of them, the average POW had been held in over five years. So, and a lot of times that was a lot of time in solitary confinement. So what they did, they brought all the POWs in from the outlying camps, and they put them in the Hanoi Hilton. Well, there was 50 to 60 guys to a room. So they were able to help one another. There was, some of those guys weren't in too good a shape, and some guys had just given up. You know, some of them been there 5-6 years, 7 years. I had one of them at one of our reunions come up and said, "You guys saved my life." I said, "Well, how's that?" He said, "He'd been a POW 7 years." And he said, "I just felt like it wasn't worth it and mm-hmm. was ready to put an end to it." And then you guys showed up and renewed the faith that people cared about him and would do anything. And it sent a message to Hanoi that, you know, we can get in your backyard. I mean, we owned that land for mm-hmm. 30 minutes. And the beatings got less, the food got better, and then was able to have a camaraderie amongst the POWs.
Really?
And they started teaching classes. They had math classes on calculus and languages, where they were learning how to speak different languages from guys that had gone to language school and were training. Mm-hmm. So had their mind, kept their minds going, and their they knew things were getting better. So,
wow, incredible story. So Terry, you've recently come out with a book about the Santee raid. Who will go? Can you tell us about that?
Yes, sir. Yes. It's get the
awesome.
Advertising there.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, it it starts out, and when I started writing the book, I sent an email out to all the Raiders and POWs and stuff and said if they wanted a memorable moment in the book, I would add it. And I've got over 40 different, I call them short stories, that either POWs, pilots, or support people or other Raiders wrote and put in the book. And It's we've been getting a lot of good press on it, I guess. If you go up to Amazon and look at the reviews, we got over 70 reviews now, and they're all five. It's written in a way, it's conversationalist. Mm-hmm. Like telling them, just like I'm talking there right now, telling the story.
Yeah.
The POWs are an amazing group. If you ever get an opportunity to hear them speak, mm-hmm. I highly recommend it because they just have a whole different look on life and understanding what they went through.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal story. I've heard many POWs speak over the years. It's always riveting and amazing how they kept the faith. And you did mention one of the key elements is the way they survived was maintaining the faith and keeping up the hope. And if they gave up that, then they didn't last too much longer.
Exactly. Very true.
Well, Terry, we're about out of time here. Appreciate you sharing your phenomenal story. Looking forward to seeing the book out there and have to check that out. And
I hope people enjoy reading it. It's written for non-military as well. It's amazing how many women have read it that I have got emails from and telling me they really enjoyed it. And we tried to make it very easy for non-military people to understand. A lot of pictures. A lot of people didn't even know I could write. So, my co-author is Cliff Westbrook, and his father was pilot of Line 2. On the refuel. So we've made it authenticated as much as we could. There's several books on the raid. Mm-hmm. This was the first one written by anybody that was on the ground. And most of them are by pilots or POWs and things like that. But my daughter, when she was going on Afghanistan, asked me what I did in the military. So I thought, well, I'll just write a book. And it was written from her kids and kids and my grandkids down the road more than anything else. So, but... Mm-hmm. It's pretty factual. We've made it anything in there we can document. So
that's great. Well, Terry Buckler, I appreciate you sharing that phenomenal story and look forward to seeing the success of your book out there.
Great. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being
here
today. Take care. Thanks for your service. Bye-bye. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Bull Simons Ops Center podcast. The Simons Center is a program of the Command and General Staff College Foundation, a nonprofit that supports scholarship, outreach, and soldier and family support on Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. We operate entirely on the generosity of our donors. To support the Bull Simons Ops Center, go to thesimonscenter.org and click on the donate button. We welcome support at any level.